From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana, plus novelist Alexander McCall Smith. He's coming back to Sacramento with a new book and a series on HBO. And a new production of All My Sons, Arthur Miller's tragedy about a man who sells faulty parts to the military in order to save his business. First, the homeless people who were living in Sacramento's tent city have now moved on. Some are now just a few hundred yards upriver. Others have gone to shelters and other places. Today we're going to try and answer this question: what's the most effective way to accommodate the long-term homeless? More shelter beds, more hotel vouchers, legal campsites, or what? We have a variety of guests in our studio. We're going to start with someone who's been an Insight talking about this topic several years ago, Jason McCannell, who's an independent social scientist. He did his doctoral thesis on homelessness in the Sacramento area. Jason McCannell, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You are unconvinced that adding more shelter beds is a cost-effective solution to homelessness.
Well, all of the figures I've seen show costs to whatever agency or foundation is paying for a shelter bed running around, well, higher than $100 a night. And when I found out that the average cost of a hotel room in Sacramento is $98 a night, and that we currently have a 30% vacancy rate in the 9,000 hotel rooms in town, it just seemed to me that you could probably get more people indoors for longer by doing something with the hotel industry, allowing people to occupy some of these unused rooms.
With all due respect to the homeless people themselves, are there many hotels that would be interested in participating in this?
Well, certainly, because a lot of hotels are already housing homeless people on a regular basis. People who are supported by monthly checks, for instance, SSI income, very commonly go into, say, a motel for a week or 2 weeks of the month that they can afford, and then they're back on the streets or in shelters for the rest of the month and repeat the cycle each month. Now, if you're talking about chronically homeless people, people who've been on the streets for years have very serious problems. We're actually fairly successful at getting them indoors with the 10-year plan to end homelessness. The population that's out there, 1,200 a night at the most recent count, is becoming less disabled, more of an able population of people who probably can succeed in an independent living situation rather than chronically homeless.
Do you think that hotel vouchers are preferable to shelter beds simply because they're cheaper, or is there some other benefit?
Oh, there are huge benefits to a hotel room over a shelter, the overflow or cold weather shelter at Cal Expo being a typical example. The shelter demands a regimen of lining up, of starting out really in the middle of the afternoon to get in. And then there's no storage. It's a shared housing situation, a dormitory-like situation. And you're ejected onto the streets very early in the morning. And there are obviously a lot of things in a hotel room that a shelter doesn't have that will help you get on your feet: a telephone, your own bathroom to wash up in, and just having the right or the privilege of being able to go in and out at different times of day, be able to seek work on non-traditional schedules, which will very often be the jobs that are available to people who find themselves homeless.
We're talking about the most effective ways to accommodate the homeless. My first guest, Jason McCannell. Let's turn now to Ray Trethewey, Sacramento City Councilman. He represents downtown and adjacent areas that are among the most affected by homelessness, including the former site of the Tent City. Councilman Ray Trethewey, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning.
The City Council last month approved $1 million to free up more shelter beds for homeless people. How do you respond to Jason McCannell's position that perhaps hotel vouchers would be more cost effective?
Well, I'm not sure hotels would be receptive at the numbers required because of other compatibility with other guests and guest services. What we did, we supplemented the county's efforts to address the social services for the homeless. Where I've been, lack of a better term, camped out for a long time is permanent housing with support services. I think Queen Cottages is just a great example.
These are very small units north of downtown.
Right. I think they're 300-square-foot units, but there's 62 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we need to build more of those to address the chronic homeless problem.
Okay. The voice you just heard there was Greg Bunker, who's executive director of Francis House, a center for the poor in Sacramento that provides counseling, motel vouchers, and advocacy. Greg, welcome back.
Good to be here.
What do you make of this issue of the effectiveness, including cost effectiveness, of shelter beds versus hotel vouchers?
Well, we do voucher families with children into motel rooms, and we're currently spending $1,000 a month for a room. So that brings the cost down to about $33 a night for a nice motel room. We've been in the business since 1970 of helping people who suffer poverty, but just as of late, in the last year, for the first time, we're being solicited by motel operators who are struggling to keep up in this troubled economy, who want our business. And that's
But that was not the case before, or less the case before?
No, it was less the case before. There were only a couple motels on 16th Street that would accept our voucher system, and where we pay monthly for the rooms and then place families in there for a week at a time. We are talking to SETA right now as these emergency relief funds become available to work on providing more motel rooms and opening it up to couples without children, because that's one area where even with the strides made to bolster the winter overflow shelter and extend it till the end of June, that's one part of the shelter that is running out. There is a waiting list for couples who want to stay together.
Well, let's just say the city had freed up $1 million for motel vouchers instead of shelter beds. Would you have been, and your peers and other agencies, would you have been able to find enough motel beds to soak up all those people?
I'm very confident that we would. But, you know, all of the shelter providers and the permanent housing efforts being made by John Foley and others are needed. And what we need is a wide variety of solutions to people because, you know, the homeless are just as diverse as the rest of us in this country, and our needs, their needs are just as different. And so what shelter situation would suit one family won't suit another who either has mental illness, paranoia, can't be in a dorm site, or has a job, or has pets. There are some allowances being made for pets and for storage for the first time ever, and I applaud the city's efforts for stepping forward to answer as many needs as they can. But we're having a demonstration today at 2 o'clock at the south steps of the Capitol to demonstrate the need for safe ground, which we mean by that
campsite space.
Supported, sanctioned areas that are out of the way where small groups, maybe 20 tents each, could be tented there.
Okay, we'll return to that topic in a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to bring in John Foley, who you referred to, Executive Director of Sacramento Self-Help Housing. John, first of all, anything you'd like to add to the discussion about shelter beds and hotel vouchers?
Hi, Jeffrey. We're not so interested in, frankly, emergency shelters or motels. What I like to be able to do is to help people, and it seems to be what people mostly want, get into a more permanent housing-type situation. I was out looking at property yesterday because the city and their $1 million, a little bit of that's going to come to us to lease some property so that we can house some of the folks who used to live at Tent City.
But you're talking about longer-term solutions, not something that's meant to tide people over shorter terms.
Well,
or
well,
not.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Isn't that what's interesting? is a solution that's actually
somewhat of a solution.
I'm not saying
there's anything wrong with it. I'm just wanting to make sure I'm
and
understanding.
And in this case, you know, there's an opportunity to, they develop a list of people who were at Tent City who we can sort of help. And the folks who have property, you know, it's interesting these days. A lot of folks, investors are going into places like Oak Park and South Sacramento and North Sacramento and South Natomas and are buying property for maybe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, putting $10,000 or $15,000 in. And they can afford to lease that back to me at a pretty reasonable price. And they're willing to have me move in some folks from Tent City. Like I saw a property yesterday has a little 2 one-bedroom units and then a little 3-bedroom house behind it. I can move in a couple of couples in each of those 2 apartments. I can move in a guy with a dog in that unit in the back, plus another person. And we can accommodate some folks in a way that is different than what you can do in a motel.
Well, how does that compare cost-wise with shelter beds and motel vouchers? Is it more or less expensive to try and set up?
It's less expensive. Like the apartments rent for $550 a month. for each apartment. So I could put a couple in an apartment, and the rent's $550, which is less than the $1,000 Greg has to pay for the motel room.
Jason McCannell, how does that sound to you? Does that make sense to you that even though hotel vouchers might be more effective, cost-effective than shelter beds, that leasing more permanent space would be even more cost-effective?
I think the problem is that the casual housing piece never goes away. We're never going to have a situation where someone becomes homeless in the afternoon in Sacramento and is in a permanent housing unit that night. There will still be a lag. There still needs to be some kind of institution that can absorb people between either a solution through an organization like John's or their own solution with their family or employment or whatever. There needs to be that wiggle room, and we can't have everybody. I think up to 50,000 people experience homelessness in Sacramento every year, and to provide every one of them with a permanent home is just not feasible. It's not viable.
Councilman Ray Trethewey, whatever the solution is, the government is going to no doubt come up with a good portion of the money. How does the city look at the kind of housing that John Foley's talking about, leasing more permanent space rather than shelter beds and motel vouchers, which are by their very nature, I think, short-term?
Yeah, well, as you can tell by this conversation, it's a very complex issue. And Greg mentioned the diversity of the one-day homeless coming out and the year or two-year homeless. So we have a multiplicity of answers to your question. The city has a very large role. We wish the state would have a larger role because it really does come down to resources to seed, you know, the fine work of Greg and John and many other homeless services.
But if leasing property for longer-term accommodation is cheaper in the long run, why not look into that more than shelters or hotels?
Right. Well, absolutely. I think it's a good idea. In fact, John was sharing me that's in my neighborhood. That's a half a block away, and we would very accepting my wife and I to have them as homeless as neighbors. Well, no longer homeless.
I didn't know that yesterday, but it's true. We were looking at a house that I think we're going to be leasing and maybe move people in as soon as next week that's only about two blocks from Ray's house.
Yes.
So we're trying to get diverse, but that's more diverse than I realized we were. It's kind of nice.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn now to camping. Jason McCannell, how does that factor out when you look at it from a cost efficiency point of view?
Well, I'm very much in favor of developing permanent casual housing options. And I don't mean tent cities. I mean, we have a lot of appropriate space for campgrounds in urban Sacramento. And these don't necessarily have to be homeless services. These could just be inexpensive places to stay in the urban area. Likewise, I think that we could have hotels that cost a lot less than hotels cost now that don't necessarily provide the same level of luxury or convenience that hotels do, but that do get people inside, get them legal. More than anything else, get them legal, because our climate is survivable year-round here. We're not in Minnesota.
You're not talking about tents, then?
It could be tents, but in a real, I would like to see a real campground with landscaping and bathrooms, just like you'd find at a state park. And state parks manage to put up a whole family for $15 a night. I don't see why you couldn't have something like that close to downtown Sacramento.
Councilman, what do you make of that idea?
I'd like to investigate it, sir. I really would. I mean, it's very interesting because we're talking about roofs over the head, but you had a tent or a permanent roof, but it's a social services. You know, if it's medical, if it's employment help, you know, those have to be part of the equation. I don't think you can just have a place to stay.
Greg Bunker?
Yeah, I think everyone here would agree that the ultimate answer is low-cost permanent housing for every man, woman, and child in Sacramento. But we're a long ways from being able to provide that or have that in stock. Until then, we need all of the above. We need shelters that exist now. We need longer-term housing. We had transitional housing at Mather. We need motel vouchers. John and I right now are working on a plan to use some of the emergency relief funds that we would provide his candidates for permanent housing with a segue from the streets into his housing. As he's developing more housing, we might put them in a motel to keep them safe and off the streets until, there's an opening for permanent housing.
But what about the minority of homeless who are homeless by choice? It's a lifestyle issue for them. isn't there a risk that they would just see a campsite as being their long-term option?
Well, in a recent survey of the people in Tent City, the vast majority said that they would jump at the chance to have permanent housing. So there's very few anywhere that would disagree with that equation. However, again, we lack that now. There are two kinds of people in Tent City. There's the newly homeless that are living in shock, who may have been living in their car and had it towed away, and then they have no resource but a tent. There's people that are have addiction problems that aren't ready to come indoors. There are people that actually don't have an option. The shelters are nearly brimming right now, and with the estimate of 1,200 people homeless, where are they? Well, they're living in the shadows and corners and streets and under bushes. And right now, Tent City has moved further into the woods in hiding. That's not the answer. Once we have a few sanctioned areas for safe ground, we could bring services to that area. We could bring porta toilets and water and garbage pickup.
Let's give the final word to John Foley of Sacramento Self-Help Housing. Any final thoughts from you?
Well, we've talked to people for about 15 years who come to us for housing help who are homeless, and without exception, they want some place that's permanent, that's safe, that they can close the door, that they'd be secure. They can't get medical treatment, they can't get employment, they can't do anything without that. On an interim basis, if there are motels, and Greg and Alex, his is working on that, that's a safe place on a short-term basis. But even a tent in a secured area would be better than sleeping in a car where you're always in danger of someone towing it away, or sleeping under a bridge where you're really vulnerable. So, you know, we'd be happy to see at least some improvement in safe places for everybody.
Okay, well, thank you all so much. We've been talking about housing options for homeless people in Sacramento. Our guests all in our studio, City Councilman Ray Trethaway, he represents the downtown and adjacent areas. Jason McCannell is an independent social scientist who studied homelessness for his doctoral thesis. Greg Bunker of Francis House, a center for the poor in Sacramento. And John Foley, executive director of Sacramento Self-Help Housing. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, novelist Alexander McCall Smith of number one ladies detective agency fame. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's an Insight podcast. You can sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, spring cleaning on a big scale. Not just your house. What idea, institution, tradition, or person would you like to spring clean out this year? That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The prolific novelist Alexander McCall Smith is on the road again, and he returns to Sacramento this weekend. His latest book is another installment in his number one ladies detective agency series. It's called Tea Time for the Traditionally Built. TV versions of stories from the number one ladies series are also now running on HBO. Alexander McCall Smith joins us by phone. Alexander, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much indeed, Jeffrey.
What do you think of the HBO dramatization of the ladies detective agency stories?
I'm absolutely thrilled with it. It's very, very good indeed. You know, authors, I think, often are very concerned when filmmakers say that they're going to make a movie of or television series of their books, and they wonder what's going to happen. They get very worried, and then often they complain when the thing comes out. But I'm certainly not like that at all as far as this is concerned. I'm really, really pleased. It's a very, very, very good version of it.
How involved, if at all, were you in the dramatization?
Well, not very much. I saw the scripts and was able to comment on the scripts, but generally speaking, authors are kept rather in the background in these things. But I did go and visit the set when they were filming the pilot in Botswana, and that was very interesting. I spent a couple of days on the set there. That was when Anthony Minghella was directing the pilot. It was unfortunately his last film, but he made a wonderful job of it. So I met the actors and actresses, and I've met all the principal actors in the series, and I'm just very, very impressed. But it's over to the filmmakers now, really.
When you were and are writing these books, how visual is it all for you? How much of an image did you have of Precious, the main character, and the other people in the stories? And what was it like seeing someone else saying, this is what they look like?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I hadn't really thought very much about that until, obviously, they made the movies and I met the actors, in that I tend not to be a particularly visual writer when I'm writing the books. I don't actually see the faces of my characters. I see the place. I think I concentrate on the place in which I put them, so I see details of their surroundings, etc. But as far as the faces are concerned, oddly enough, I just don't see the faces of my characters. I see their general shape, in a way, and sometimes what they're wearing, but I don't see their faces. So when I met Jill Scott, who plays Mara Matsui, the principal character in these books, when I met Jill for the first time on the set, that was fine by me because I didn't have a preconception of what Mara Matsui should look like.
My guest is Alexander McCall Smith, the novelist. He's in Sacramento this Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Pavilion Shopping Center. He's joining us from on the road on his book tour. You're famous in part for being so busy. You juggle many books, many series of books, and various other interests. How do you find the energy and the enthusiasm after all these years for all this work and travel?
Well, I very much enjoy writing, so from my point of view, there's never any real problem with that. It's something that I really want to do. I'm happiest when I'm writing, so I don't really have to force myself to do that, and that enables me to write quite a number of books. As far as the travel is concerned, well, that's a different matter, and that can really get quite wearing. But what cheers me up at the end of it is the meeting the readers, because I meet the readers, and I find that tremendously energizing. It's great fun meeting the readers. People ask you questions about the books. In fact, many of the questions they ask make you think about what you're doing quite seriously, and it's great. But the business of airports, I could probably give that a miss. I'm a real expert on airports, by the way. If you want my views on airports, I'll give them to you.
When you were on our program in 2006, when you were talking at California Lectures in Sacramento, there was one thing that you said that a couple of people who heard the interview brought up with me afterwards, and that was how when you were on airplanes on that book tour, you spent the time in the airplane writing the latest installment of this daily novel you were writing, I think for the Scotsman newspaper. And that really struck people because most people would think, well, if I'm on this long, grueling travel, the last thing I'm going to do is work when I'm on the airplane. I'm just going to kick back. But you just went back to work again. Do you still do that?
I find airplanes quite nice places to write, actually. I've just been on an airplane from Indianapolis to New York, and I managed quite a bit of my new Isabel Dalhousie novel. It takes your mind off the fact that you're suspended 30,000 feet or whatever it is above the surface of the Earth in a metal tube. If you start thinking about that, well, you know, that's not very relaxing. So what you do is you just write, and you go off to somewhere else altogether.
Alexander McCall Smith's latest book in the number one ladies detective agency series is Tea Time for the Traditionally Built. Now, there are various subplots in that story, but one of them involves the proprietor of a local football team who's enlisted the number one ladies detective agency to help explain its dreadful losing streak. The owner of the team is convinced he is a traitor in his midst. What gave you the idea for that?
Well, I thought that I'd like to write a bit about football in Botswana, that is soccer, because I found that that's something that people are obviously very interested in. And the football players in Botswana all have wonderfully colourful nicknames. If you read about their matches in the paper, you'll see that some of the players are described by nicknames such as 12 Volts, so-and-so, and, you know, very, very nice names. So I thought that I'd delve into the world of Botswana football, because I don't know a single thing about football, though. That was a problem in that how would I write about football when I didn't have the first clue about it? And so I consulted somebody I knew who knows about football, and I said, tell me about soccer. And after about 10 minutes, I said, that's enough. I know enough.
You must be in a relative minority in the city of Edinburgh having no interest in football.
Yes, I am. Most people seem to be keen on it, but I don't really get the point of it. I mean, I understand that it's very balletic in a way. It's a very intricate game, and it's, you know, they describe it as the beautiful game, which I suppose it is, if you look at it as a sort of ballet performance, which really people tend not to look at in that particular way. I'm terribly sorry. The listeners will be wondering why I'm not going to answer the phone, but I won't. I'm enjoying talking to you.
Alexander McCall Smith, the novelist, is my guest. Separate from your career as a novelist, you've had a long and successful career as a law professor and an international expert in bioethics. Do you have any time for those pursuits now?
No, alas, I've given all that up. I had to make a choice between my career as a university professor or as a career as a writer, and I decided that I'd be a writer. So I said goodbye to all that, and I miss some aspects of that, but this keeps me busy enough.
Do you keep an eye on bioethics?
No, not really. I don't. I notice what's in the newspapers, so I inform myself, I suppose, to that extent. But the difficulty with many of these fields is that they are so, how would one put it, they're so fast-moving and so complex that you really have to look at them closely in order to keep on top of them. And I found that I just don't have the time for that anymore.
Now, another pursuit that you have is what's called the really terrible orchestra with capital R, capital T, capital O, and you're the bassoonist in this ensemble.
Yes.
Now, I read that you've moved to a different instrument, the contrabassoon.
I've moved to the contrabassoon.
Why?
In the hope that I might sound a bit better on the contrabassoon, which I don't, actually. I mean, a contrabassoon's a lovely instrument. It's a great big instrument. I like these big bass instruments. Mind you, there is one advantage for the contrabassoon when you're as hopeless a player as I am, in that the notes are rather deep. They're obviously considerably deeper than the ordinary bassoon. And when you're playing deep notes, it's very difficult for people to tell where you go wrong because it's all just a low grumble. So it's provided excellent cover for my lack of skill.
And has someone else in the really terrible orchestra picked up the bassoon, or is that gone now?
Well, we've got one pretty good bassoon player, well, pretty good useless player, obviously much better than I am. And she keeps the honour of the bassoons going. And I try to sort of follow roughly which way she's playing. We've recently toured to New York, you know. We came to New York, the really terrible orchestra, which was an amazing thing. We gave a concert on April Fool's Day, and it went down terribly well. New York audience couldn't believe it.
I can imagine. Alexander McCall Smith, author of several series of books, most famously the number one ladies' detective agency. The latest installment is Tea Time for the Traditionally Built. The number one ladies' stories have also been turned into a TV series now running on HBO. He's in Sacramento this Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Pavilion Shopping Center on Fair Oaks. Alexander McCall Smith, it was a pleasure talking with you again.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Could you live on $4 a day? Tomorrow you'll hear about a food stamp challenge in Yolo County, plus why acupuncturists from around the world are gathering in Sacramento. Also, we'll talk with the great country and rock guitarist Bill Kirchen of Hot Rod Lincoln fame. He's coming to town. And we'll hear from Sacramento singer-songwriter Autumn Sky about to release her first album. Should marijuana be legalized and taxed? That's what a bill in the California legislature aims to do. Joining us with his analysis of the pros and cons of this hot-button issue is Michael Vitiello, distinguished professor and scholar at Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. He recently wrote a piece for the Sacramento Bee on this very topic. Michael, welcome back to Insight.
Glad to be here.
Well, what are the main arguments in favor of what this bill, AB 390, would do? Why would one want to legalize and tax marijuana?
Right. Well, anybody who watched the budget crisis in the legislature knows what the attraction is. California's got a huge cash crop in marijuana that remains untaxed. So if it really could yield significant taxes, that would be a strong plus. And, of course, it might lead to some reductions in the prison and jail population. Those are the pros.
Do we have any idea how much tax revenue might be generated by legalized marijuana?
Well, you got to look at the estimates. There are estimates of about $1.5 billion in taxation, and then another $1 billion in savings. These are the pro arguments. And I suggested in the op-ed piece, I think we have to look at whether we ought to legalize marijuana with a holistic perspective, because I think these claims are probably inflated. For example, on the prison side, yes, there are some parolees who go back to prison because they have a bad urine test for marijuana. But in many of those cases, they might go back to prison on other charges. They might be picked up on more serious offenses, but the authorities use a cheaper method of a parole violation, quick and easy to get them back into prison. So we need to look at the data a lot more closely before we can be too enthusiastic about the rewards on the positive side.
So the savings, we don't really know. The high end presumably is $1 billion because that's what the proponents
are saying. That's right. That's right. And then another $1.5 billion in taxation. And that's, I think, again, it could be higher, but it could be lower. I proposed in my piece that there are some reasons to think it might be lower. For example, unlike making a good bottle of wine or sipping whiskey, growing your own marijuana apparently is reasonably easy. I just picked up Michael Pollan's book again, Botany of Desire, and reading it makes me think that growing marijuana would be something people could do. And we already have a gray market in marijuana, so people are out there growing marijuana privately.
So you're saying basically that unlike more complicated products like whiskey and wine, people, if marijuana were legalized, what's to stop them just growing their own?
Sure.
And drying it and doing whatever they need to do?
That's right. And I mean, because the argument is, the pro-argument is, it's just like the end of Prohibition, when effectively once we got rid of Prohibition, then you could easily tax whiskey. And it really destroyed the mob activity. Well, it's a lot harder to make that argument in connection with marijuana, that suddenly the underground trade is going to go away. I don't think Humboldt County is going to change its complexion.
My guest is Michael Vitiello. He's a professor at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. We're talking about his analysis of the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana. Let's talk about the arguments against it.
Right.
There are a few.
Well, there are. And again, I think when you listen, part of the problem with the debate is that the debate is dominated by the strong yes and the strong no advocates. I mean, the real extremes. For example, some folks are arguing basically, and this is a little bit of hyperbole, but it's the end of Western civilization that will lead to far more marijuana use and far more addiction. Now, if that's true, that's a really strong reason not to legalize another illegal substance. My own view really focuses on two things. One is that marijuana is already readily available. So that, for example, when I was working on the op-ed piece, I asked my criminal procedure class. I didn't know what an ounce of marijuana cost. And within moments, I had responses I did it by email. And within moments, I had responses with websites that could price marijuana. I mean, if you want marijuana in our society, it's already so readily available, for example, in the gray market in California because of medical marijuana. So, I don't think there are going to be large numbers of people who have not had access to marijuana. The other and I think more important thing is we have a lot of people who, if they are attracted to a particular substance, do so because of their own brain chemistry. Schizophrenics are heavy smokers because of the dopamine effect. People who are depressed self-medicate with cigarettes, for example. They're much higher users of tobacco than normal folks. And so rather than a lot of us, I assume that a lot of people might try marijuana if it suddenly becomes legal.
So there might be a spike.
There might be. But as I say, because it's so readily available now, I doubt there are going to be hordes of people. And again, it may depend on how much advertising goes on and the like. But I think what will happen is that for most people, they'll segue back to their drug of choice. If you're a red wine drinker, you're not going to suddenly become a marijuana user because the red wine is probably doing something for your brain and body that the marijuana will not.
In your piece for the Sacramento Bee, you also wrote that even if marijuana were legalized and taxed, the illegal product might remain cheaper than the legal. Why is that?
Well, again, one of the things you've got to recognize is that, but I was quite cautious in what I said. I mean,
sure.
One thing, you're going to be taxing it, and therefore there'll be incentive to grow your own, or the providers of illegal marijuana will try to avoid taxes. I mean, there's no question about that. Let's look at the reality. But, you know, the antis are saying that it will always, that the illegal product will always be cheaper than the legal product. That is not entirely true, because the illegal product will always require some costs, some transaction costs that are not reflected in the legal product. For example, muscle.
Yes.
The risk, the lawyers, the criminal, you know, getting busted and the like. So, you know, we'll be making a lot of choices that will influence all of these things. And it's not as easy as it looks at first blush.
If marijuana were legalized, then presumably it would fall quite far down the list of priorities among law enforcement.
Right.
That, in turn, would reduce the risk faced by illegal black market producers. And that presumably would drive down the cost of the illegal product.
That's true. But again, as I mentioned, there'll be choices involved. If we really, and here's one of the central ironies, you know, if we really are doing it as a revenue measure, then the state has increased incentive, for example, to allow advertisement, and they might have increased incentive to bust the illegal users. So, you know, all of these things are difficult choices. We're looking at a moving target, and to come up with these easy conclusions about the effect of legalizing marijuana is just too hard in the abstract.
We're talking about the issues raised by AB 390. It's a bill in the California legislature that would legalize and tax marijuana inside the state. Michael Vitiello is a professor at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. One last angle here, the feds, are the ultimate arbiters of drug law. Now, there's a new administration, and the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, says that the feds won't raid state medical marijuana clinics if operating within state law. But it seems to me this would be an entirely different proposition for the feds to say, hey, we won't bother with that either.
Of course. And there are a couple of features here. One, as the news conference where the president took email questions, where what was demonstrated quickly was that he doesn't think legalizing marijuana is a sensible thing. And why should he take that on? I mean, he's already got so much on his plate. To be the president, in a sense, to open up legalized marijuana at this point would be just too difficult. The other thing is there are lots of institutions within the federal government that have a vested interest in drug enforcement. And he's not lightly going to change that culture. So I think if California growers are waiting for the day when the feds are just going to give a green light to growing marijuana in California, I think it's going to be a long time coming. We're going to need sort of a new approach, a new president who doesn't have all of the things on his plate like Barack Obama does.
And then if, as inevitably happens, the administration changes,
right,
all bets are off.
Right. You know, if you were considering becoming, and I know you're not, but if you were considering becoming a marijuana grower and registering with the state, giving the state your name and address and paying a licensing fee, you would think long and hard, because that information now would become available, presumably, to the next administration if we get a conservative administration that wants to crack down on drugs again. There you are, a waiting target.
So to sum up, it seems to me like there's a lot of gray area in this issue, and it sounds like a lot of arguments for and against and counter-arguments to those arguments for and against.
That's right, and a lot of choices that we could make. For example, there may be ways to do a legalization program and not have some of the bad side effects. It might also, for example, healthcare, mental health care, because a lot of people self-medicate using illegal drugs. So there's so many choices to be made that you need to sit down at the table, not with the normal crowd and not with the police organizations, but instead with some of the really serious scientists who look at these things and look at hard data.
And with an appropriately clear mind.
There you are.
Michael Vitiello of University of Pacific's McGeorge School of Law. He's also director of McGeorge's Center for Advocacy and Dispute Resolution. He recently wrote an op-ed piece for the Sacramento Bee analyzing the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana. There's a bill, AB 390, in the legislature that would do that. Michael Vitiello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a new production of All My Sons, Arthur Miller's tragedy about morality and desperation. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight details at capradio.org/insight. All My Sons is a tragic play by Arthur Miller about a man who sells faulty parts to the military in order to save his business. It's running in Sacramento at River Stage. Joining us to talk about this play about morality and desperation are the director and two of the actors. We'll start with director Frank Condon, who's also artistic director of River Stage. Frank, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Where does All My Sons rank in the Arthur Miller canon? Is it a play that should be better known?
I think so, yes. This is the third play we've done by Arthur Miller. We did Death of a Salesman in 1995, which was a huge hit. American Clock in 2004, which also did very well. So it was time to do another one, and this is a play that I've always wanted to do, and audiences respond to.
Summarize the plot for us, the main parts of the plot.
Well, it's a little complicated, but what happens is Larry, the son, the eldest son, has not come back from World War II after 3.5 years. The mother, Kate, believes that he's still alive. She's really the only one in the family that does. And there's a tree that's been planted in the backyard to commemorate him. Anne, the girlfriend of Larry who died, has come to the house to marry Chris, his younger brother. And, of course, the tree falls down that night in a tremendous windstorm. And this picks up the story of why everything's being focused towards him still being alive. The mother says Kate says that if he's not alive, then Joe, the father, is responsible. He's the armaments manufacturer.
And tell us what he did.
What he did was he sort of sold his partner out. Both of them were put in prison for faulty machine parts from engines for P-40s were sent out and they were cracked, and 20 planes went down because of that. And so the play deals with Joe, the main character, trying to hold on to the lie that he's not responsible.
Where did Arthur Miller get this from? Was it based on a true story?
It was, yes. He said he found it in a newspaper article about faulty parts that were sent out in World War II tanks that caused the tanks to fall apart. Essentially, not fall apart, but became inoperable.
It's quite a grave issue.
It is a grave issue, and it's an issue that we're facing today. There was, as you probably know, a situation where body armor was sent out to our Iraqi troops, and they had 16,000 of them had to be recalled because they were faulty.
We're talking about All My Sons, the play by Arthur Miller, which is running at River Stage in Sacramento. Frank Condon is director of the play and also artistic director of River Stage. Two of the actors are with us too, Claire Lipschultz and Dan Featherston. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here, Jeff.
Claire, who's your character? Who do you play?
My character is Kate Keller. I am the mother of Larry, the soldier who has not returned, as well as a younger son, Chris, who is living with the family, and, of course, the wife of Joe Keller.
You know, I should say that Larry did fly a P-40, and that's an integral part of that plot that I failed to mention.
Now, Dan, who do you play?
I play Chris Keller, the son of Kate and Joe, and of course, Larry's younger brother as well.
So you two are going to do a scene for us. Frank, could you tell us where we are?
Yeah, it's the night after the windstorm. The tree is blown down, and the girlfriend of Larry and soon to be, they're hoping to be married, soon to be wife of Chris, has just arrived. And Kate is at wit's end now because of the fact that it went down the night before. And she thinks it's a confluence of energy.
Okay. Well, let's hear the scene then from All My Sons.
I had a terrible night. I never had a night like that.
What was it, Mom? Did you dream?
More than a dream.
About Larry?
I was fast asleep and... Remember the way he used to fly low past the house when he was in training? When we used to see his face in the cockpit going by? That's the way I saw him, only high up, way, way up where the clouds are. He was so real, I could reach out and touch him. And suddenly he started to fall and crying to me, Mom, Mom! I could hear him like he was in the room. Mom! It was his voice. If I could touch him, I knew I could stop him. If I could only... I woke up, and it was so funny. The wind, it was like the roaring of his engine. I came outside. I must have still been half asleep. I could hear that roaring like he was going by. The tree snapped right in front of me, and I, like, came awake. See, we should never have planted that tree. I said so in the first place. It was too soon to plant
too
a tree
soon.
For him. We rushed into it. Everybody was in such a hurry to bury him. I said not to plant it.
Mother, the wind blew it down.
Couldn't...
What significance has that got? What are you talking about? Mother, please don't go through it all again, will you? It's no good. It doesn't accomplish anything. I was thinking, you know, maybe we ought to put our minds to forgetting them.
That's the third time you said that this week.
Because it's not right. We never took up our lives again. We're like a railroad station waiting for a train that never comes in.
Get me an aspirin, eh?
Yeah, sure. And let's break out of this, okay, Mom? You know, I was thinking maybe the four of us could go out to dinner a few nights. Maybe go dancing out at the shore.
Fine. We can do it tonight.
Yeah, let's have some fun. You'll start with this aspirin.
Very nice. Claire Lipschultz and Diane Featherston in All My Sons. Claire, what do you make of the play?
Well, I think it is an extremely relevant, timely play given its themes about individuals feeling that they have a responsibility to, or should have the responsibility to, community outside of just their narrow interests and their narrow family. In the story, Joe and Kate love their family very, very much, and in part did what they did and made the decisions they made in order to protect the family. Unfortunately, those decisions did not take into account the dire consequences for the larger family of humanity, if you will.
Diane, what about you?
Yeah, I think Claire is right on the ball. I mean, it's really has to deal with what are you prepared to do for your family and your loved ones, and at what cost, and at what that cost will in there happen to the people who are suffering, like in the war. You know, Joe did this for his family, to have built something more for his family, but yet what did it cost in the long run? And really answers and questions a lot of those things. It really makes you think and ponder about that sort of stuff.
Frank Condon, another thing that stands out for me is this strong superstitious element that's part of the story, which is sort of contrasted with a very gritty reality that's also part of the story.
Yeah, there's a character named Frank who is into astrology. And he wants to convince Kate that the day that Larry died was his personal day. It was he's saying because of the astrological charts he couldn't have died that day. So there's a whole theme about that sort of thing that Miller's dealing with. But essentially, you know, as everybody else said, he's linking individual society at large, and raises the questions about business ethics and personal responsibility.
You mentioned earlier, Frank, that this is the third Miller play that River Stage has done. Is this part of a plan to do all or many of Miller's plays?
Well, if I'm around that long, yeah. Yeah, I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, every 3 or 4 years or so, yes. I think we're ready for another Miller.
All My Sons runs through May 17th?
That's correct.
At River Stage?
It's 7:30 Thursdays, 8 o'clock Fridays and Saturdays, and 2 o'clock on Sundays. And the telephone number is 691-7364.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Frank Condon, director of All My Sons, also artistic director of River Stage, where the play is produced. Two of the actors were also with us, Claire Lipschultz, who plays Kate, Dan Featherston, who plays Chris. Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Mara Ponce, and Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Can you live on $4 a day? On the next Insight, you'll hear about a food stamp challenge in Yolo County, plus why acupuncturists from around the world are gathering in Sacramento. Also, the great country and rock guitarist Bill Kirchen of Hot Rod Lincoln fame is coming to town, and we'll hear from Sacramento singer-songwriter Autumn Skye about to release her first album. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.